I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is declassifying documents. In particular, documents from the Soviet Union, which over the last 20 years has seen more and more documents be released related to the secret police and its monitoring of individuals, both prominent, well-known, and your ordinary citizens. And as these documents have come out, it has very much changed the landscape for the study of the history of the Soviet Union, as information that was once thought to be lost is now available for public use, for public consumption, and for the use of academics. And the volume of material that has been published is incredible. There's a lot of material out there, very difficult to wade through it all. And there's so much out there that our guest today has described it as an archival revolution, which, conveniently enough, is also the title of her book, Reading the Archival Revolution, Declassified Stories and Their Challenges, by Christina Vadalescu, who is a professor in the Department of Comparative Literature at NYU. And what's interesting about this book is that it's not so much a history of the Soviet Union. It's not essentially using the archives the way historians typically do, but it's more about how to approach the archive, how to read the archive, and taking her expertise in literature and applying it to these archives that have been declassified. So it really gets into questions about declassification, how to approach archives, how new material can be understood and interpreted, especially in an era where the archive is contested. To a certain degree, all archives are contested, but the Soviet Union has different circumstances from stuff we might see in North America. So a really fascinating book about an issue that is ongoing, that more documents are being declassified in the various republics that were part of the Soviet Union, the centralized documents. A little harder to get to now, given that they are in Russia. So there's a lot of factors at play in accessing, understanding, interpreting these materials. So a wonderful book, and I was very pleased to have the opportunity to speak with Christina a little earlier. So without any further ado, let's get right to that conversation with Christina Vadalescu. All right, and Christina Vadalescu joins me now. Christina, how are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great. Very excited to talk to you about Reading the Archival Revolution, Declassified Stories and Their Challenges. Now, before we get into the book itself, I'm a little curious about your background and how you came to this particular topic, because it is certainly a book about history, but it's not necessarily a history book, and you're not in a history department in your job down there at NYU. So I'm just curious as to how you came to this project and maybe how you consider it, because it's a project about historical sources, and historians, I think, are going to be very interested in the book, but it's not a quote-unquote history.
That's right. So I'm a literary and visual culture scholar, and I guess the main thing that there are probably many things that keep me coming to these archives. I've been working in them for the last 20 plus years since they've been declassified and declassifying. I think one of the things is just the challenge of reading, right? So the fact that I often find myself in front of some of these documents, and even though, you know, I've spent my life reading, they present serious challenges. You know, how do you read this X-ray that I find of a prisoner's lung that I find and that I start the book with, for example? How do you read these images next to the text? How do you read them together? So that's one place that I come from, and the other is more autobiographical, I guess. I was born in Romania in the 70s and grew up in the 80s in Ceausescu's Romania, which was probably one of the grimmest places in the socialist bloc in the 80s, and grew up with an awareness, I think, like everybody else, of our lives being written, you know, somewhere, not my particular life, but my parents, you know, just growing up with this awareness of these texts that I think I was aware of before I even knew that there were books. So even though I'm a literary scholar and I love books. I kind of understood, I think, the power of these texts. I think that the personal file was probably the most powerful writing genre of the Soviet era, the secret police personal file. So yeah, I just wanted to use my knowledge of reading to try to make sense of them for myself and hopefully for other people as well.
Yeah, I think so, because for me, I look at personnel files all the time in my job doing primarily First World War military history. So we look at personnel files all the time, a little different from the personnel files that you're talking about, but the same idea is that how do you read them and how do you understand the information that comes out of personnel files? So for anyone who hasn't yet read the book, what type of files are we looking at? You mentioned the secret police, but typically what is in a file that the Soviet police were compiling on individuals?
Yeah, so this changes quite a lot through time, right? From, I would say, you would have a much more kind of schematic file in the 1930s during the Stalinist purges, for example, where it would be mostly interrogation files, interrogation records in the file. And then as time goes on in the 70s with the boom of surveillance technologies, files become very wordy. And so a lot of what you see in the 70s and 80s are wiretapping records and other types of surveillance files. But there are all sorts of different kinds of files. I guess the most infamous are the personal files that were kept on an individual, right? And they sometimes included that individual's voice in the shape of, you know, transcripts of conversations that were bugged or even direct conversations with the interrogator. Sometimes in the case of writers that I look at, you have their autobiographies. So these files have lots and lots of, one of the things that you can tell about them is that they are really diverse. They're really hybrid in what they include. They can include everything, right? And that's part of the power of the secret police, is that nothing was supposed to be beyond its reach, right? But then you also have other kinds of files that people know maybe less about. There was a type of a very, very important file that was called the problem file that was looking at whole groups of people. For example, Radio Free Europe had one of the biggest problem files in the Romanian secret police archives, right? Or different minorities, the Roma people, the German minority, the Hungarian minority had problem files. So yeah, different kinds of files. In my first book in police aesthetics, I kind of do an anatomy of the secret police file as a genre of writing. And I look at, you know, kind of the contents of it and also how they change the time.
So I'm curious about the question of how you came across these documents and the declassification process. I was lucky enough to be in Hungary this summer and went to a couple of the museums there. And what really fascinated me was the question of when the wall comes down and the Soviet Union is gone, the question of justice and how do we come to terms with this period. And some of the stuff, from my assessment, was sort of, it seemed like they just want to hide it away and let's not talk about it and close that door. Other things were very clear of let's address it and be public and move on. Like, so it seemed like it really ran the gamut. So for these documents in particular, you mentioned that they were declassified within the last 20-ish years, but not immediately after the end of the Soviet Union. So what was the process through which the documents were declassified and what was the motivation to have them declassified?
That's really important, your observation that there was that they ran the gamut of the reasons why they were declassified and also the timing of the declassification. So first it was the fall of the Iron Curtain that made any of these declassifications possible, right? And they happened at different times in different countries. For example, in the early 90s in Russia, there was a lot of declassification and people got scholars and regular people, there was a lot of excitement around it. Different countries followed depending on the kind of political parties that were in power. This is because declassification was truly linked to a process of lustration. So the legislation in different countries basically asked that access was given to this archive so that people who are running for public office could be checked to see whether they had been secret police agents or informers before. And again, the legislation was very different. For example, in the Czech Republic, it was at a time very stringent. You know, in order to be post office master, you had to have been checked against the former archives. And in other countries, like in Russia, you know, you can to this day be the president of Russia and have been worked for the secret police. So it was very different. But the process of lustration was one of the big triggers, but also one of the reasons that there was a lot of resistance to the opening of the files, because people were afraid. They weren't just like this dead archives. They were really very much in the midst of political controversy all through this period of. And then there was also the question of rehabilitation of people who had been criminalized under the previous regime. And so that was an important trigger too, people kind of looking for their justice, right? People who had a criminal record and for that reason couldn't get, I don't know, retirement benefits, you know. So there were also private people who were looking for their own justice, and that also contributed to this process. And then, you know, then we also come the historians and the scholars and the journalists and whatever. Yep. Who are also interested in kind of understanding and in kind of developing historical knowledge. So many different, it came from many different quarters, this push towards declassification.
How do the documents necessarily change the way that we can study the Soviet Union in general or the specific histories of the countries in question? Because in looking through some of the names that you've mentioned and looking at the book, the files that are being compiled, especially of people who are considered, you know, agitators or whatever, it doesn't really surprise me some of the names that come up that, of course, the secret police were following these people. So I'm curious, from a historical perspective or from your perspective in reading the documents and understanding the importance of their declassification, as you mentioned, there's a lot of questions associated with it, including privacy of those individuals who might still be alive. But does it change, or how much does it change the way in which we can study and understand that period of Soviet history in general and the individual national histories of these countries?
I think it changes our ability to understand in kind of very dramatic ways and in very complicated ways. So, you know, within the field, this whole process is called the Archival Revolution. That's the title of my book, Reading the Archival Revolution. Because of the immense scale and also kind of drama and impact that this process had, especially if you consider what came before, which was just a lot of secrecy and inability of scholars to travel and do research in many of these, not just secret police archives, but also state archives or party archives. Then quite early on, historians started worrying that there's this very interesting article called the Gold Rush, right? The archival gold rush. Is it just that we're getting all this information? Shouldn't we also revise our methods? If we ask the same questions, will we get kind of limited answers? And so I think it became apparent pretty early that we are seeing new documents, and we also need to, that the archival revolution can only really be revolutionary if we also change the way that we ask our questions and consider our methodologies. Now, it's also quite uneven, the way this happened, and the kind of documents that we got access for. For example, even starting with the perestroika period in the 80s in Russia, we started getting quite a lot of information about, even formerly classified information about, the Stalinist period, the Stalinist purges, the 30s. So we have that area much more covered than others, right? Than more recent history. And then in the beginning, in the 90s, there was so much interest in the Russian archives and all these Western archives, like the Hoover archives, for example, worked in partnership that I think, I know, that a lot more access was had to Russian language archives than to other national language archives. There were just fewer funds and less interest. Now, as especially after the war started in Ukraine in 2015 and then more recently with the full invasion, we've had a lot less access, dramatically less access to Russian archives. So basically what happens is that now a lot of historians, scholars in general, are going to the archives of the satellite states, of the former republics, and getting information. And so that's a very different kind of information. We're starting to have a more kind of peripherally rooted view of the Soviet Union, which I think is interesting. And it kind of is a good corrective for a very kind of Russo-centric perspective that we had for a long time.
Well, that's interesting because I'm curious, as you say that, how decentralized was the archival process or the document process and within the Soviet Union? Like how much of what was being collected was coming from like orders, were coming from orders from the Kremlin compared to within the states themselves, within the republics, and then how much was being reported back to the Kremlin and how, like just how centralized was it and how valuable are the files that are available within the former republics?
It was quite centralized and in all these within the Soviet republics, but even with the satellite state like Romania, it was Soviet counselors who established the secret police in the satellite states and also kind of their whole recording and archiving system. And so you have documents that are still classified in Russia that are, you know, about how to, what you ask me, you know, how to open a file, how to keep up a file, all these things that are kind of internal documents about the functioning of the secret police and especially of the archives that are still, you know, totally classified in Russia. But you can see the same document in Russian in a Ukrainian archive. So a lot of information can be gotten and is gotten.
Now, as you mentioned off the top, you are a professor of literature, right? That's what you do. So I'm curious for, you know, historians, we have a very specific training on how we are approaching archives and approaching documents. How do you approach a newly released document or newly available materials? And what is a valuable or productive approach to this just mass of files that you now have access to? It's so many things that take forever to read each individual page. So I'm just curious as to how you would go about approaching and what methodology you take when you're going through such a large and new collection.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I learn a lot from you guys. So my book is in many ways kind of a methodology of reading. Like it takes these reading challenges and tries to develop, to kind of identify them and find and tackle them, right? And what you mentioned, first, what's not in the archives, right? The things that we don't find, but also the huge mass of these archives. Those are the challenges that kind of frame my book. The first one is the silences in the archives, and the second and the last one is the incredible excess of documents that we are now faced with. So I go through all sorts of methodologies developed by historians as well as by literary scholars, and I try to fit them to the materials. So for example, with the archival materials that are full of gaps and silences, I use a lot of close reading. And when I get to the excess part, I actually take advantage of methods from digital humanities of, you know, graphing data, for example, in order to visualize things that might otherwise not be, you might not be able to see in a close reading, right? So, and I really kind of go to everything in between close reading and distant reading. We call these two methods in literary studies, right? I read along the grain and against the grain. And that's not because I think everything goes, but it's precisely because there are so many different kinds of materials that I think in order to ethically and effectively approach them, we need to really kind of bring everything we've got and everything we've developed together in different right. fields to the table and work with them. So yeah, that's and I think another maybe another example that I could give you is that these archives are incredibly diverse also in terms of mediums and languages, so that oftentimes we are trained within one medium, right? Literary scholar. And so, but they wield power and they make meaning in the collusion of different media. If you just think of a very simple example is the mugshot, right? You have the two photos. It's not one, it's two, and that's important. And then you also have the caption. And the image or the words don't make sense except together. And so, you know, that's taken at a whole different level when you have secret police photographs and films and files. So then I try to use and to develop strategies, reading strategies from all these different fields, visual studies and literary studies, and put them together to deal with each case.
You did mention earlier that there are some recordings too, that you have the ability to hear voices. I'm just curious on the technical side of it. What are we looking at for those materials? And can you take the same methodological approach from something that is visual to something that is audio?
Very interesting. Yeah. So in fact, a lot of the wiretapping produced tapes, but then they were transcribed quite immediately, and the tapes were usually used and reused and overused. So it's very rare that we have the sound. And even when we do, like I know, you know, some sound files, it's oftentimes that, you know, the archives don't have the technology and the funds to have the playback machines and things that would fit. But I do work with films that have both image and sound. There's a one particular genre that has fascinated me for a long time is reenactment films, where the secret police captures a suspect and then they make them reenact their alleged crime in front of police cameras, right? Mm. And so for that, you have what looks like this really strange hybrid of, you know, documentary and fiction film, which is the reenactment film, and they contain sound and they contain voices, and then you analyze all of those things, both with respect to the specificity of each medium and then together as this intermedia artifact.
Very cool. In thinking about it too, though, I'm curious about how trustworthy the material is, right? A wiretap is one thing where it's sort of this raw audio, but reports that are being filed by the secret police, I would come into that with a presupposition about how trustworthy these documents are. But at the same time, things that aren't being made publicly available in the moment, or there's no expectation that maybe they'll be publicly available, maybe they're a little more honest, the officers who are writing it. I don't know. So how do you go about trying to assess the trustworthiness of these documents, and what is the methodological approach that you can take to assess that, especially where some of the other sources that you might be getting are clearly biased or clearly aren't trustworthy? I'm just curious how you wade through that, what I would imagine is a significant challenge.
Right. And some of that is really kind of going back to very, you know, traditional and important historiographical strategies like triangulation and comparing different kinds of art of documents. And I think part of it is also letting go of the belief that you'll find the truth about the victim or the subject of the file, which is where most of the disinformation, you know, goes on. So it's often hard to see these as trustworthy documents in terms of learning something about the people who were arrested and who were recorded in the files. But I think looking at these archives in a certain kind of critical light, we can actually learn a lot about the secret police itself, about the institution itself, right? About the way it worked on a daily basis, about also its fears and anxieties, about the hierarchies, about the fantasies that it had about itself, about... So I think that obviously you have to take everything with a grain of salt and with a lot of care and check things, because sometimes you would see a police document that says, oh, this person, they used what they called, you know, compromising materials. But they wouldn't tell you that this is something that they created, right? They would just say, oh, this person was caught red-handed doing this. And they wouldn't tell you, oh, this is just something that we, a document that we created. And maybe you find proof of the fact that that was created by them 200 pages later, and maybe you don't. So,
and is there a way to check that approach against the expectations that people would have? I mean, you have personal experience growing up in the Soviet Union. I grew up in the West, but learning about the Soviet Union in a very specific manner, right? Specific languages being used, and the way that the history of the Soviet Union is taught to me growing up in Canada. So I think each of us would come to documents like this with a certain expectation about them. But I would imagine you would encourage people to kind of strip that away and come into them fresh, as you would want anyone to come into any new project, new documents. But how do you do that when I think the Soviet Union immediately just has it's such a loaded term, even just saying the Soviet Union, these are Soviet documents. How do you kind of strip away that background knowledge or the expectations that people have when they might be coming into documents like these?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, partly I think you're not giving yourself enough credit. Like, everybody has expectations, both in the East and in the West, and people who've lived their whole life in the Soviet system and have had a lot of interaction with the secret police and scholars who've worked there also have expectations that have been shown to be wildly wrong. So let me give you an example with Herta Müller, is one of the authors that I, on whose file I work in this book. And she's a German language writer from Romania who won the Nobel Prize a few years ago. And she was incredibly upset about the fact that she only had a 3-volume long file, only 300 pages. And that her first interactions with the secret police, which included in her telling a lot of pressure and duress to the point of psychological torture, were not recorded in the file, right? And so she took that as proof that her file had been cleaned up, had been shifted. And I follow this accusation and I look at the files, and I think that, and a lot of people had this, oh, I was a dissident, or I was, you know, there was a lot of disappointment when the police files were opened and people found that they didn't have a file, because in some ways, if you were someone, you were supposed to have a file. I didn't have a file, you know. But in fact, the secret police was not there to document people's acts of courage or rebellion. They were writing these files to impress their boss, to justify their salary. So for them, something that might have taken all your moral fiber, the no that you said, was just simply not as important to record. Just quickly, another example that might actually show the common misconception and misexpectations from both the West and the East concerns Michel Foucault, who spent a year in Poland, and his own story is that he was kind of kicked out of Poland by the secret police and being compromised by his relationship with a young Polish translator. And so, you know, here is the father of archive theory in the West, right, who tells this kind of Cold War spicy story. And of course, you expect that there would be files on him. Everybody that I talk to, from, you know, Western scholars of Foucault himself, Foucault's longtime partner, Daniel Defer, every, you know, scholar from Eastern Europe that I talked to, the director of the national, of the IPN archives, of the secret police archives in Poland, everybody thought, yeah, there should be files on this guy, right? And what we found with Anna Krakus, we co-authored a paper, is preciously little, partly because at the time when Foucault was there, it happened that the secret police had just suffered some very serious internal purges. Their personnel was really down, you know, they were understaffed, they were overwhelmed. And this guy who was going to be very important for all of us in a few years was a graduate student who was just finishing his dissertation. So we find some traces of him, but we also find a lot of ways of like learning about our expectations that is, I think, instructive.
And you mentioned that sometimes the reports are just bureaucrats being bureaucrats. It's good to know that bureaucracy is universal. East, west, wherever you are, there's bureaucrats doing reports here and there to get raises and all that. I'm curious, though, about the question of personal agency within the documents themselves and whether you can find evidence of agency on the part of the people who are drafting the documents. Again, the idea, I think, that gets presented of the Soviet Union is very monolithic of the state. But I'm curious as to, within the documents themselves, can you find things about the authors, the people who are putting these documents together?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. And the moment, this is kind of what you guys, historians, do too, right? It always happens earlier than people thought, and it's more complicated. So my answer is, there are so many different kinds of people writing these reports, right? And I think they have different amounts and kinds of agency. So I'll tell you a little bit about it. The subjects often write quite a bit of their file, right? They are called in to give reports about what they talked about in a meeting with a foreigner, you know. And a lot of the agency of the subjects is to make themselves obscure or illegible, right? So it's not expressing yourself.
Right.
It's the opposite. It's creating some sort of a mask, right? Then there are kind of the lower level agents who are writing reports, and they have, you know, some agency into what they write, and they rely on a whole army of other writers that include translators that the secret police hired, right? In the case of my writers, Herta Müller was writing in German. The secret police agents, they didn't read German, so they had to have these translators. Well, those translators had interesting agency because they could leave out things. They could make choices in their translation that would make the text seem more ambiguous or actually more incriminating, right? They had literary interpreters. They would call in professors from, you know, departments like mine, I guess, to say, like, tell us about this text. What does it mean? Should we put this person in prison for it? They would have archivists who would then, you know, file these things. But what's interesting is that we imagine the person writing had some agency. The most powerful person was not the person writing, but the person reading, right? There was a hierarchy between those who wrote the reports and those who read them and could cross through them and could say, well, do open a new file on this person, right? And then there are all these purges, right? So these hierarchies are not stable. People go up in rank, as everywhere in bureaucracies, but more pertinent to the secret police in Eastern Europe, who all suffered these purges, they also might have had a lot of agency one day and then lost it all overnight and become one of the people investigated.
Mm-hmm. And is the collection, or are the collections such that you can follow individuals on the side of the police, whether like the readers, can you follow careers? Is it set up that way that you can, it's one thing to understand the subject, but can you find traces of individuals throughout the thread of their career in these documents as well?
You can. They have these amazing statistics that they compile, you know, at the end of the year for their superiors, where they show, you know, this officer managed to recruit so many informers, and they look like tables, you know, like the plan for producing wheat. Well, the plan for informers was that this officer had to recruit 10, and he surpassed the plan, he got 12. But I want to say one thing about the agency, because it's probably the most controversial and maybe interesting question of the informer, right? Did the informers have agency? Could they say no? Could they not inform? Could they, in some ways, help the person they were informing or not? And there is a huge literature, and again, it depends on the country, on the time period. But one of the most amazing finds to me that, as I read, concerns Laszlo Tökös. And Laszlo Tökös was, you know, this man who, in a very simplistic understanding of Romanian history, that would be about like one person having agency, he would be the one person who's considered to have started the Romanian Revolution of 1989. He was a pastor who, you know, rebelled against the regime, and the uprising in Timișoara started around defending him. Okay. Now, he had been, as a student, asked to be an informer, pressured to be an informer. And we have records of these meetings where it's pretty clear that he's not excited about becoming an informer. But there are records written by the recruiting agent. So what you see is just a pretty kind of standard language. And at some point, you see the agent getting really irritated by the fact that this guy signed his informer's agreement, agreed to inform, and then went out on the street and told every single person that he met that he signed an informer's agreement. And they should know this. So that was one way of asserting his agency. And various things like this happened. Within a short time, the secret police decides this guy is useless, and they close the file on him. They close the file on him as an informer and as a subject. He was, you know, the one person to follow, the one person who brought down their downfall, and they followed thousands of other people, you know. So, yeah, the questions of agency, I love it. It's interesting. We could talk.
Absolutely. Another part of agency that fits into this is that there's a lot of people who have files that are talked about in the book who are still alive, or who certainly were alive in the post-Soviet era and left interviews. So there's a lot of oral history that you have from individuals who are profiled in the files themselves. And I'm curious about how the two methodologies of oral history and these oral accounts of people, especially those who are still alive, mesh with the paper documents in this archive that has now been declassified, and how these two things can work together, especially when there are conflicts with what's in the documents and what the oral history might be saying. And I mean, one of the things that I like about a lot of the history that I do is that, I shouldn't say I like this, but it's conversations with the dead, essentially. And so you have the stuff that you have, and any new things that might come out in the documents can't be taken personally, or you know what I mean? Like, or somebody can't be trying to defend a legacy or hide something or whatever. Like, it is what it is in terms of what their memory of it is. And there's no living memory of a lot of what I do, but that's very different from this situation where there is still a lot of living memory of this era. So how do you kind of combine those two areas where you have living memory, you have oral history, and then you have this treasure trove of documents that has been declassified?
I do a little bit of that, you know, in the Foucault article, we interviewed Daniel Defer, Foucault's partner, but there are a lot of people who do a much, much better job of that because they are trained. You know, so for example, in my field, Catherine Verdery, who is an anthropologist, has done amazing work. She wrote this book, My Life as a Spy, where she looked at her own file from communist Romania, where she was a researcher in the 70s and in the 80s. And then she went out and invited her handlers, her informers, her agents to lunch and talk to them. She also wrote an amazing book on collectivization with Gail Klickman, where they both do this and they write kind of an addendum on the methodology of doing it. There is a collective, the Hidden Archives Collective, that does work on religious minorities in Eastern Europe, and they are really great about getting into contact with the religious communities that they're studying and that are in the archives, and linking them with the with the documents and eliciting their response is really interesting work. I don't feel I'm trained to do that, right? I think it takes real training, and my training is in looking at text. So the equivalent of what I do for that is that I read the documents alongside the memoirs that some of these people wrote then and now, and the fiction that they wrote then and now. And so, for example, with Herta Müller, I read her files. Her files include a lot of her literature in translated forms, in the original form. And I think that her texts are kind of guides to reading the files. So I think we all have our own strengths and areas of training. So I do fewer interviews, but I think that that's incredibly important. I find a lot in reading the literature, whether fiction or nonfiction, of the some of the subjects of the files.
The book talks about how this is still an ongoing process, right? The archival revolution, that it's still happening, that new documents continue to come out, continue to be declassified. So for anybody who's interested in this history, the history of Eastern Europe, and anybody who might be an archivist or just really anybody who's interested in Eastern Europe and the legacy of the Soviet Union, what is the expectation moving forward of how these documents are going to be continued, how the documents will continue to be declassified, and how we can continue to approach them? And just really, what do you think will happen moving forward with respect to just the availability of material from the Soviet era?
Yeah, so we live in very strange times, right? So in some ways, a lot of people working on the Soviet Union, and particularly on Russia and the Russian Federation, it's a huge crisis, right? There are all these people who've started their research projects just to find that they no longer have access to the archives, right? It's really kind of dramatic and terrible. And I know a lot of colleagues who are just shelving their research at this point and finding, you know, new topics, sometimes, you know, 10 years into doing a project. On the other hand, people are finding alternatives and solutions. And as I said, some of the alternatives are working in the Baltic states, are working in Central Asian archives, are working in Eastern European archives, Ukrainian archives. And this gives us a different and I think more complex and kind of, yeah, I think a more multi-voiced perspective. But it's certainly not over. Some people think that the 2015 opening of the Ukrainian archives is kind of the beginning of the most recent stage of the archival revolution that we are in, because so many documents are available through the Ukrainian archives. They've done an incredible job of not only welcoming people but also digitizing everything. So, but these are very hard times, I think, for archival access.
Yeah, and that's what makes the book so important and so relevant. And again, it is Reading the Archival Revolution, Declassified Stories and Their Challenges. Christina, if people want to pick up a copy of the book or keep up with all the other work you got going on, you've written other books. What's the best way for them to do that?
Oh, that's very kind of you to ask. My book, Reading the Archival Revolution, is available from Stanford, and I would love it if people got it. My previous work also on the topic of secret police archives in Eastern Europe is Police Aesthetics, and it's also available from Stanford and from Amazon and anywhere people
can. Yeah, and we will link down in the show notes to the new book, Reading the Archival Revolution, so do check it out, again, from our friends at Stanford University Press. So Christina Badalescu, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sean.
So there you have it, my chat with Christina Vadalescu, and I thank her for her time. Again, the book is Reading the Archival Revolution, Declassified Stories and Their Challenges. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week. which comes from Policy Options, November 25th, 2021, by Timothy Andrew Sale and Susan Colburn, entitled Canadians Will Be Glad to Know. And this is an article that is noting the challenges of the access to information system, the backlog that exists, the argument that perhaps too much is being redacted in the documents, particularly those that have surpassed 40, 50 years of age. The question of, are the documents going to cause embarrassment to the government or individuals? They're arguing that no, at that point, they will not, and that they are in the public interest and that they should be available to all Canadians and certainly academics as well. So it's very much a call to action, if you will, for the access to information system. They're calling specifically for a 30-year rule for government documents, with an exception to those that are particularly sensitive government secrets, because the reality is that there are things within the federal government, within all levels of government, that need to be retained and need to be secret. Certainly, you think of things relative to national defense and national security. There are issues there, as well as issues of privacy for individuals who either work for the government, contracted by the government, whatever it may be. There are issues certainly at play. But at the same time, the access to information system, as anyone who has gone through it knows, is not the best. There are challenges with return times. There are challenges with what gets redacted, what doesn't get redacted. And on the government side of things, there is a lack of resources available to those who have to process the access to information request. In particular, questions related to who is the subject matter expert, who is actually doing the review and the redacting. It's a challenging system. And this year at the Canadian Historical Association annual meeting, there was a panel full on about the access to information system and the continued challenges, the continued delays with the system. So even though this article is from 2021, it could have been written yesterday in terms of some of the challenges associated with access to information. And as Christina talked about in our conversation, having material be public really is important. It's critical that information be out, that there's transparency in the government. And as the book demonstrates, as material comes out, as information is available, it changes the history, it changes the stories that we know. And it's important that we have the skills to go through archival information, new documentation that comes out. But at the same time, it's critical that the information is made available, which the book very clearly lays out. So certainly different situations with what's going on. The declassification of the Soviet documents does not translate one-to-one to the access to information system in Canada, but the core principle of ensuring that material is available as much as possible are central, I think, to both of these books. So today's historical headline of the week from Policy Options, Canadians Will Be Glad to Know, by Timothy Andrew Sale and Susan Colburn. And with that, I will say thank you very much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, likes, rate, comment, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show and keeps us growing. Head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab, plus all the great written material. And if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's old is news at gmail.com. So thanks again for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old is News.